Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome. How are you? Nice to meet you. Are you new here? Well, you can just sit. There's some open seats. Sit wherever you want. It's general admission. Sure, you can sit in your car. Of course, you can sit at your desk at the office. Yes, it's no problem. You could sit on that bench press. Be careful, though. Pay attention to what you're doing. Get a spot if you need a spot. I can't talk you through that. I don't want to be the guy saying this in your ear while your chest is being crushed by weights. What do you? Yeah, you can certainly sit in your own kitchen or stand there and do your dishes, your laundry. You can do your laundry. You can cook. You can paint. You can throw a pot. This episode is dedicated to the throwers of pots, to the throwers of cups and mugs, to all the clay throwers. Is that, am I not saying that right? Potters. It's your episode today. This is for the potters. I do want to tell you that today on the show, I have David Chang, the chef and founder of the Momofuku restaurants, which are around the world, all over the world. You might also know him from his Netflix show, Ugly Delicious, or his podcast, The Dave Chang Show. He's got a new show on Hulu. It's called The Next Big Thing You Eat. It's premiering today. Also got a cookbook out this month called Cooking at Home. He's also a kindred spirit, a kind of a guy trying to figure out how to enjoy life guy. But incredibly talented dude. He brought me over some chili sauce. David Chang brought me a Grateful Dead record and this Momofuku hot sauce. I'm looking for a picture of it so I can tell you what it is because it was fucking amazing. It was like you could put it on anything, I think. I think you could even put it on ice cream if you wanted to. Momofuku chili crunch. Damn. I ate like a whole thing of it in like 2 days. And this isn't even a promo. It's not paid advertising. I like when people bring me presents. It's very nice and it's a good conversation. So anyway, people, last night I played a gig at Largo and it went well. It was great. My band is very good. Can I call my band? That's the weird thing. I've wanted to do this all my life, and I still wrestle with the idea of, like, do I deserve to do it? Do I deserve to do it in front of people? Aren't there people that deserve this more? I've been playing guitar my entire fucking life, and when I was younger, I did not have the confidence to play in a band. I did not have the discipline to learn songs. I'm still not that much different, but I'm a much better guitar player. But given this opportunity, I'm taking it, but I still enter it thinking, like, do people really want to hear me, Mark Maron, play guitar and sing my songs? But I'll tell you something, I fucking love it, and I feel like I've been waiting my whole life to do it, and there's something electrifying about the fear of taking the stage, which I don't have as much anymore with stand-up, but just I've always felt that when you sing and play guitar, there's a vulnerability there, for me anyways, that I can't hide. And it's very interesting to do it in front of people and then come out of it and do a little stand-up because I'm basically raw and open and needing of a certain amount of approval that I have to give myself in that moment because I know when I play okay. But, you know, I definitely have dropped into the pocket a little more. I'm a little more relaxed. You know, it's exciting to play with Jimmy. You know, I can hold my own a bit, but I got to stop comparing myself to people that have been doing this for a life or a living or their jobs or everything. I play earnestly with a certain amount of feeling and I'm capable and I can sing all right. And that's that. There's a couple stops and starts last night, but like, I think it went pretty good. I think it went pretty good, and it was a good time. And you know, going into it, I just was, you know, I'm not terrified, but I really have to, you know, push back a certain amount of fear, and I really feel like that electronically, that my amplifier picks up my insecurity. And I don't have any understanding of what it's like to play in different size rooms or why it sounds the way it does, because I play in this garage or I play in my office room and it's just me and a guitar and it sounds great. But when you get into the real world with this stuff, it's like there's a lot of, you know, random stuff going on. And I somehow, like, by the middle of the show, I'm like, do I even want to finish? I mean, Jesus, haven't I done enough? I'm relieved. I was exhausted by the end of it. We did, I think I really did a good version of Oh Sweet Nothing by the Velvet Underground. Everything went pretty good. The groove on Mystery Man by Tom Petty was a little hard for me. I've got to practice singing and playing at the same time. But I've got this thing in my head where it's like, I'm not like some big star where my playing is automatically, or me wanting to play in a band is automatically going to disappoint people. It's like, who the fuck does he think he is? But, you know, I'm a mid-level celebrity that does a lot of different things. And now guitar is another one of those things. And I do it okay. And it's pretty entertaining. I accept me. You hear that, Potters? Put that in your head while you're squishing the clay. You clay squishers across the world. Sammy's got a new nickname, Smushy. That's how you know, like, how much you talk to your cats is revealed and how many nicknames you have for them. Buster is Booster, Busty, that's about it. Booster and Busty. Hey, Booster. Hey, Busty. What's up, Busty? Sammy is Sammy, Sammy Red, Schmooly, Smushy, Samster. Sammy, Smushy, the Smusher. So I'm a man who talks to his cats a lot, clearly. Just ask Smushy or Schmooly or Sammy Red or the Sam Man. I never called him that. I do like Smushy, though. I do like Smushy. Oh, my God. I ate about 19,000 calories and nuts last night. That's how I party after a gig. So, David Chang, we got right into it. We got right into it. No fucking around. We have some common friends. And now I can tell you that I enjoyed the hot sauce. And I like watching him cook on TV. And this was nice talking to him. The Next Thing You Eat is now streaming on Hulu. His cookbook, Cooking at Home, comes out next Tuesday, October 26th. I would like a copy of that. Could someone arrange that? Thank you. Yes, please. I want that. I'm sure, at the very least. But he did. He already gave me sauce, and he already gave me a Grateful Dead box set. But what would it? What would it cost? Anyway, you know what? This is for another time. I'll deal with it off the mic. This is me talking to David Chang. I like food, but I'm afraid of fat.
You really like food, and I think you looks like you're a really good cook. And I know you watch a lot of cooking shows. So,
well, I used to, and I do. I have a sense. I do get better. I do cook, but I'm limited, and I'm afraid of cream. I'm afraid of milk, and I'm afraid of cheeses. So, like, it's all pretty. It's all pretty straight ahead, you know. But like, I can cook a pretty good steak. I do fish all right. Fish is tricky, but like, I never do Asian,
right?
Because it looks relatively doable if you have the supplies, but I just don't do it.
Well, I think that's just it's not preference. It's just, it can be daunting if you're not familiar growing up with it.
Right, because there's a million things that you got to kind of have.
But at the base level, I think you just need like soy sauce and sesame oil.
Yeah, got that.
And that's...
That's it?
Pretty much.
Scallions.
Scallions. I use a lot of scallions. And that chili crunch is good on everything. So.
But I love that episode. How's your kid, by the way? I mean, I saw you have the kid.
Yeah, I just, my wife had another baby 2 weeks ago.
Really?
And he's great. Yeah.
So now you have two. How old's the oldest one? Pretty fresh still, right?
You know, 2.5 years, yeah.
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 And you're adjusting all right?
Yeah. You know what? I have it easy. My wife, God bless her. She's not sleeping so much, but
I'm
doing okay.
Yeah, you don't get up and do the thing.
I help take the breast milk bottles, and she pumps like every couple hours. Yeah. I bring that down every 2-3 hours.
And did the mission to create baby food? You know, are you doing that? Or?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that would be very difficult to do.
But I thought that episode of that show of, what is it, Ugly Delicious, where you talk to these other people and how they handle childhood, child rearing or feeding children and, you know, the way you're going to live the life of a chef and still have the kid. I mean, I thought that was all pretty, broad and expansive in terms of the different types of people that are in your business that had kids, yeah. and the choices that people make to have kids, but you're not gonna open a restaurant in your house.
I think it's difficult for any parent to have or anybody to have a kid,
yeah.
But particularly difficult for people that work in the restaurant industry because of the hours and it's just unrelenting. In the service of others.
Yeah, why are restaurant people so fucking crazy? Because, like, I worked in restaurants when I was a kid, right? And I've known a lot of chefs. But, like, when I was in Boston, you know, working at it, just being a counter cook, like, I knew chefs. And there was more blow, more booze, more insanity, you know, in the world of restaurants. And I guess it's all about, you know, the immediate gratification of delivering, serving, creating that just becomes addictive, right?
Yes, there are. I feel like maybe there's like three professions where something happened to you in your childhood and you become this profession, like porn stars, comedians, and chefs.
But there's also the inherited businesses, which is not based in trauma. Like, you know, my dad was a plumber. It's not traumatic.
Right.
I just took the business over. Right.
A lot of it is again inherited because it was built on the French military system. Mm. Like the military's fucked up.
Yeah. you mean the modern kitchen?
Modern kitchen is based on Escoffier, this old French guy that codified French cooking, built it on the brigade system in the military, which is why it's like very strictly a hierarchy.
Right.
And if you see how unfortunately the military operates in the training of things.
Yeah.
It's not a surprise that it would be adopted by, you know,
and
chefs.
And the chef is the general. And now is the sous chef, that seems like a pretty nice name for the prep guy.
Well, there's a lot of fancy names. So the chef technically means boss.
Yeah.
Sous in French means under.
Yeah.
So it's like the second. Underbug.
Okay.
But there are all these stratifications of the word chef, executive chef,
right.
Chef de cuisine.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my peers don't like being called chef. Chef is almost like a derogatory term.
What do they like being called?
Just
their name. Oh.
And you know, you can like, what's up, chef? Like you do that an insult.
The difference between a chef and a cook, right?
Big difference. But, you know, today in 2021, titles, who the hell knows anymore?
Yeah, who cares, right? Yeah, I mean, if you're a good cook, like, you know, for instance, like on some level, and I'm just because it's fresh in my head, the old pizza episode you did, you know, that guy is kind of a cook.
Absolutely.
The guy who has that place.
Yeah, I mean, almost all of the pizza guys that wind up being pizza guys, they almost taught themselves, right?
Like, yeah.
And this is a big debate.
Really? I love these big debates that only certain people know about.
Exactly. Nobody, that's why I'm like, no one cares.
No,
right?
They do care. What is the big debate?
There are like two schools of thought. The really great chefs oftentimes were self-taught.
Really? Yeah.
Because they didn't know what rules to break.
Uh-huh.
And people don't really know that. Like there's a chef like Heston Blumenthal in England.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not like working chef anymore because he's so successful.
Right.
He was a repo man before he became a chef.
Huh.
You know? And it's like.
And he didn't go to culinary school.
No.
Well, that's what I realized about cooking. Like I had a professor in college that was sort of a gourmet chef, but he just learned himself and his kitchen was set up properly. And that had a profound effect on me when I realized like, if you have a knack for this shit and you understand it, you know, you can do it.
But that I think is the difference in cooking is not everyone has a knack for it, but you can still be really good at it.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, because of repetition.
Okay. You know? But like, I mean, in a sense, like, and I've said this before, only that, like, in order to make a recipe, you have to be able to see it in your head and understand how it fits together. I think the reason why people fuck up recipes is they're seeing the, you know, dumping the thing in 2 tablespoons. They can't picture what they're making. And if you can't picture what you're making, it's how are you going to fucking make it right?
Well, you know, I got a cookbook coming out that talks about this, the intuition. And I have this like theory brewing in my head that maybe all the recipes that we follow is the reason why people are so bad at cooking.
Right.
Because it would be like following instructions to have sex.
Right.
Nobody does that. That's ridiculous.
Well, you need to know the basics.
Yeah. You need to know the basics and then you move on.
This goes in there.
Yeah. But there's a lot of people that still follow the recipe like they're still following recipes for sex.
Where does this go? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I have a lot of comedian friends and I toy around with this idea of, is there this general pattern of how you do things in life, whatever it is, these schools of thought.
Yeah.
And I think that is incredibly difficult to be a great improvisational comedian. People think you can just do it.
Yeah.
But you got to work at it to be good.
Well, I do a lot of improvising on stage and I'm doing it now. And I realize there are guys that can't do that, but there are also guys that are afraid to do that. And they don't want to give up power. They don't want to give up control of the room, because when you step out there, I mean, there are guys who work in improv and that's their thing. But as a stand up, as soon as you go like, what's up with you? You know, then you're like, you're gambling. So, and you've got to be into that moment to sort of counter that, you know?
And there's a lot of chefs. You know, I'm more of the improvisational. I can never do the same thing twice, even though I'm supposed to.
But your craft is in place.
The craft is in place, but there are great, great chefs that look at anybody that does anything off the cuff as imbeciles.
Right.
And there are people that are on the more improvisational end that look at the rigid structure of like someone that never deviates from their set as assholes.
Right. Or, you know? or just sort of... it always strikes me as it's hard to defend because it looks like fear and it looks like conservatism in a way.
Yes, exactly.
Or laziness on some level. Like, you know, with comedy, you know, you can't go back to the same crowd with the same act too often before they're like, I'm tired of this.
Right.
And I think it's the same. It must be the same with food. And that's the weird thing about all these conversations or these arguments that you're talking about. Nobody eating the food is going like this tastes like that guy. But that's not true. I can taste when a restaurant's gone bad because there's no love in the kitchen.
That's the funny thing. It is, as cliche as it sounds, so much of the success of somebody in restaurants, I'm sure any field, is how much do they care, how much they love it. And, you know, I've spent years thinking about these not stupid topics, but I think about these things. And I've just come at the age of 44 now. I'm like, all that matters is, did someone like it?
Right.
Who cares?
Right.
Who cares?
What, in the making of it or the
whole top? I'm just so tired of the talk of it because it's not meaningful. It's not useful for people.
Right.
And I can't force anybody to go down these rabbit holes. So, you know, it's like I'm in a state of flux of trying to reevaluate what food is to me and to like everything.
But when you say food, it's like your medium of expression. So it's a big deal.
Yes, and also, like, I thought I fed a lot of people.
Yeah.
But the reality is I haven't fed that many people. You know?
Is that really the agenda as to how many people you feed or how amazing the food is?
Well, it could be both, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's to
me. But numbers, I mean, you know, McDonald's feeds a lot of people.
Yes, and I've spent my lifetime hating them, but now I'm like, well, not that I want to be McDonald's, but it's like, it's amazing that you can go to any McDonald's for the most part, and it's... the same.
But that's a consistency. It's almost an industrial consistency, right? You're not eating a burger from McDonald's saying like, the guy who made this, I can feel him in this. You know what I mean?
But what if you could, right?
Like, what if you are?
Yeah. And that's to me what I'm after. Like, you know, when you do stand up, is the balance potentially doing 100% committed to improvising and 100% committed to a rigid setup?
Well, no, I just like, for me, I guess, and this is what we were kind of talking about at the beginning, for me, it's about discovery, right? And then once you discover something, you want to share it as many times as possible until you get tired of it. And then you shelve the discovery and you hopefully discover more.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the point of expressing for me. It's this sort of me understanding something differently. Or seeing something differently, or helping other people see something differently, right? And that evolves. So it's never a strict balance. I improvise to create, and then eventually, you know, things stick, and then I run them, you know, to the ground.
This may seem too esoteric and meta, but
yeah,
I feel maybe similar. When you're talking about discovery, and I listen to you a lot, and so it seems like that's something that you're always trying to do.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there might have been irritation or agitation along the way of this discovery because you're trying to tell your audience to discover the same thing?
Sure. Because, like, and I imagine it's the same with cooking in that, you know, like, you know when something's not landing, or you know when something doesn't taste right. You know, it tastes okay, but it's still a little weird, or it's not quite right. I mean, I know that. So then it's like, I've got to sit there going, and I'm doing that now. Like, how do I fine tune this thing so it lands the way I want it to land?
Right.
You know, and that's exciting. That's an exciting process but as it turns out, and I imagine with you as well, like, you know, right when you get it perfect, you're like, I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it happens every day when I cook for my family. It's like, yeah. I don't want to eat this.
Yeah.
I hate eating it.
But did you like making it?
Not, I don't even know if I like make. I want them to be happy.
Right.
But I don't.
Right,
I don't know, man. Right. Like, I'm such a neurotic mess, man. Yeah. Like, with still? Everything. Oh God.
Yeah. Well, so what is it about then? Like, you know, this observation you had at the beginning. You know, like that. You know, comics, porn stars, and chefs. You know, have this. You know, this thing. Because as I get older, and I'm 58, I just turned 58. You know, I still learn new things about, you know, my brain and about my insecurity and about like my, like lately I'm battling with like this wave of self-loathing that I can't, like, it's daunting because you get to a certain age, you're like, maybe I'm done with that.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's like, no, I'm not. I guess I'm not. So what is it about your childhood that you identify as one of the prime movers of your need to do what you do?
I mean, I spent like 15 years in psychiatric therapy to only tackle these subjects now, really, with my dad.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And it's just a lot of, I think trauma inherited and trauma that's potentially genetic and trauma that is from your culture and your surroundings. Yeah. And, you know, I go through waves of being angry about it, but then also I'm like, you know, my father passed last summer and I'm more angry at him than I ever was.
Really?
Yeah. And in other ways, I'm much more understanding of how he became the way he was because, you know, it's just like...
How did he become that way?
I mean, he grew up in war.
In Korea?
Yeah. With nothing.
Yeah.
And he comes to this country in 1963.
Which side of Korea?
He was born in North Korea. What was North Korea?
Yeah.
And just by happen chance of a lot of random things... get to this country and, you know, you're a product of all of these things. It's almost like that Coen Brothers movie with a singer, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah.
It's like all of these things that happen turn into this person that you are. And I look at the series of events that happened to my father and I can understand why he is the way he was.
Sure.
And I can accept that, but simultaneously I can be angry at him for not being loving.
Right.
And, but then I'm like, well, Korean culture is not about being loving. It's about surviving.
Right. And it's ongoing dialogue within you. And it's also about, like, there is, like, what I've noticed with Korean culture, a lot of Asian cultures, is that there's, you know, especially children of immigrants, there's this pressure that's unrelenting.
Unrelenting.
And it's like it devastates the ability to have a sense of self other than ambition.
You know, I was watching that Tiger Woods doc.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that is fucked up.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, my dad was very similar. And I was like, oh, I couldn't watch the second half because it just touched a nerve too much. And yeah, I was never going to be the competitive golfer that Tiger Woods was, but I can relate.
So you were a golfer, huh?
That's all my dad wanted me to be.
Is a golfer?
Yeah. It's crazy shit.
But was he a golfer?
I don't even know how that happened. You know, he was like, to his credit, a Korean guy in Virginia.
Yeah.
Was a trailblazer, because now if you go to a golf tournament, a junior golf tournament, you're going to see a lot of Asian parents yelling at their kids.
Yeah, right, sure.
My dad was the first that I ever saw.
But you don't know what made him take to golf?
No idea. You know what?
It was in Virginia you grew up?
I never asked them. Like, did you ever ask your parents about things that they did? Or why they did it?
Sure.
I never had the courage.
Really?
Or even if I did, I would never get a response.
Yeah, well, sadly, a lot of times the response is like, I don't know.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah. Or my dad literally would just hear you and then turn away and do something else. Yeah.
Wow, really detached. Like, I deal with the repercussions of having, you know, selfish parents. You know, like, you know, that where the love is not, it doesn't land as love. You know, whatever they think they're doing. And I still do that joke in my act. I say, don't believe them. They didn't do the best they could.
But it's true.
They say they did, but they didn't. They winged it. They had no idea. And now we're all fucked up. And I'm not like, I'm not mad and I'm not, you know, whatever. You dealt the cards you want. But I do wish I was a little more emotionally stable and capable. Because, right, so if you deal with these parents that were incapable of selfless love, then you don't know what to, you know, you've got to pretend like you know how to love people.
And I think I'd have nothing to say.
Yeah.
I don't know. But clearly that's sort of what I long for, is to be normal.
Well, it seems like, you know, you whatever your mental disposition is, there's a sensitivity to it. Like, you feel things, and, you know, whether you have control of your vulnerability or not, you can't help it.
I got my DNA tested for the chromosomes that deal with, like, mental illness.
Really?
2 years. Yeah. It's from this, like, terrible sounding company called Genomind.
Really?
Yeah, based on, yeah. And my psychiatrist, I've been seeing my shrink, the longest relationship I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Since 2003.
Mine's, we're with cats. So.
And like, I've been on all kinds of medicines. I'm a big believer in that with therapy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been tailoring and tinkering things that would be beneficial for me and my chemistry.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where he's like, hey, there's this new thing out. I think you should try it. And I got swabbed. It was like the whole thing.
Really?
And I got a card and like a giant notebook of information about why my brain is the way it is.
Really?
It was pretty wild. It was very hard. I actually didn't talk about it for like 2 weeks until I was ready to talk about it with him.
Huh. So it's so weird, because I'm doing this joke right now about how, because I don't have kids, and I say the joke is really about like how, look, if you have love in your heart, you know, and you want to have kids. If you have a void where your heart should be and you think a kid will fill it, you know, don't do it, because that void will just continue for generations. You're carrying it, and it's generations old. And then they do the punchline, which is like, they now have this function on 23andMe where you can track your void.
But that's like sort of metaphysically like true. It's...
Yeah. Well, yeah. I said mine goes back to 1800s Belarus in Russia. It was a tailor's wife had the original void that started my family.
Yeah. I got the 23andMe. Did you get that all tested out? Do you know everything?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm 99.9% Ashkenazi Jew.
Like 15 generations ago, I have some Ashkenazi Jew.
Well, how'd that happen?
I don't know. I know. I was so excited to read that. I was like, this is amazing.
See, that's why you like comedians.
I was like, that's got to be a mistake. But if it was, I don't care. I believe it to be true.
I was hoping for some Viking blood, and that didn't happen.
Yeah, no.
Ashkenaz from Korea.
I don't know what happened, but it's there.
How do you know it was 15 generations?
They said it was like 15 generations ago or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So who knows?
That's a long time
ago. It's a long time ago.
And who the hell knows? Like, someone got lost.
Yeah. I mean, again, who knows how accurate it is, but
what is this other thing?
The mental thing is, it tells me how my body processes certain medications. So it has helped me better be prescribed things that work.
Well, what's the diagnosis?
I'm bipolar.
Yeah. Bipolar 1, bipolar 2, super bipolar?
It can be mixture between 1 and 2, really. Yeah.
And you didn't know that until recently?
I never wanted to know. I'm so neurotic that I never wanted my shrink to tell me.
Huh.
I was like, these are like agreements.
But is it because my dad's bipolar, and is it because you enjoyed the mania too much?
No, I hated the mania. I just didn't want to know if I was. I didn't want the explanation to like mess up with who I was.
Right, you wanted to be purely you.
But
you
I knew I was less worried about bipolar, but clearly I knew it because I have a hard time explaining this because I'm still processing like how to talk about it.
Yeah.
I knew I was wildly depressed. I have like massive depressive disorder.
Really?
Yeah.
For how long? Like always, or it comes?
Yeah, pretty much always.
Really?
Yeah.
So because like I don't, like with me, I don't even know anymore. Like, because I have a high tolerance for it, you know, because I grew up with it, and you don't want to, you just kind of always fighting against it. Like, I have no sense of, really, I have no kind of muscle memory for joy.
I am the same way. Again, I feel like we have some mutual friends, and they're always like, you have a similar sensibility to this Mark Barry guy.
Really?
Yeah. And when I listen to him, I'm like, oh man, like, yeah. I really feel what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know. I'm watching you two get all choked up. Like when we, with the, during your wife's pregnancy, the first pregnancy. And I've never experienced that, but I do have this free flowing kind of like emotional, like that I can't define, but it's not bad. Like a, you're kind of crying, but it's a good thing. But I usually do it alone or at weird times. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know. I've just been thinking about it recently that if you grew up feeling awkward for whatever reason, that literally you have no good memories.
And I don't.
Right. And that's disturbing. Right. Cause like, you're like, you know, what about your childhood memories? Like always uncomfortable. Never, you know, it's all my childhood memories are like, oh, why'd I fucking, that was terrible, you know.
And I feel worse when people talk glowingly about their childhood. I'm like, man,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What would I be like if
you're friends with Nick Kroll, right?
Yes, very
like,
good friends.
Like, you're very good friends with him.
Yeah.
I had to stop following him on Instagram because his fucking family looked too healthy. I literally, all the pictures of him as a kid where everyone, we love him, he's such a wonderful, I'm like, I can't do it anymore. I can't look at his happy camp pictures anymore. And I love the guy. I think he's hilarious and I like him, but I'm just sort of like, I can't. Too well adjusted. Not for me. But I love him, and he seems to have a nice new baby.
He's totally in love being a father, and he's got a great, great partner. So I love them to death, and I've known him a long time. So,
but how does how does he handle a guy like you?
I think people know. I feel like they know that I'm more balanced these days. I'm less angry.
Yeah.
And I always wonder. It's like, I'm the Eeyore of the group oftentimes. Yeah. I felt like that.
Right.
And you know what? Because I was.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You know?
So like with me, like, you know, it's harder on our partners, you know, ultimately, because it's going to come out somewhere. And I guess for you, when you started opening restaurants, it must have like, you know, you must have been a nightmare.
100%. Well, my biggest bout of depression led to opening up the restaurants, because without being depressed, I never would have been me.
What was the first restaurant?
Noodle Bar in 2004.
In New York?
Yeah.
What was the one out here in the—
Major Domo.
Okay. And that's still here?
Yeah, it's here. It's doing great. We had a great team there.
Oh, good. And how many you got restaurants?
We have over 10, but the number fluctuates because there's like more than one of each sometimes. So
what happened to Bong Bar?
Bong Bar, it's still in Time Warner, and we opened one up in the Cosmopolitan.
It still got the spit?
Yeah.
Oh, so that stuck.
It's so good.
That was such a great, that whole history of the spit, I enjoyed that episode.
I'm glad you did, and I'm glad
people— That seemed to be a revelatory episode.
Getting to go to Istanbul was like, holy shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it made me realize what a boring fucking country this is.
Absolutely. Like, 100%.
Where it's just like, you're just walking down a street where people buy vegetables and there's a million different, and you're sitting right over here. I used to eat a carousel all the time.
You're living in the land of kebabs.
Yeah. No, I know. I don't need enough of them.
Oh, man, you got mini kebab here. You got Hamlet's Kitchen. This is the best.
Yeah, Frank loves mini kebab. Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, Lord.
Carousel's okay. A little greasy sometimes.
Carousel's
okay.
Good, but this area is Armenian heaven.
I know.
I love it. I come here all the time just to buy food.
Really?
Yeah.
Where do you go? Mini kebab?
Mini kebab.
Yeah.
It was just written up in the New York Times today. Hamlet's Kitchen, I love because they're trying not to be busy. I love those kinds of restaurants.
Mini kebab is just got written up?
Yeah.
So now I can't get in there?
It's already been that way, but
yeah, it's even worse.
There's so many spots here. Yeah. Hamlet's Kitchen, I think you will like a lot.
You keep saying that. Where's that?
It's like it's only like 5 minutes away from here.
Everything's 5 minutes
it's
from here.
It's in the back end of a warehouse where you feel like. The setup is because of the COVID world, but no, it's always been this way. Yeah. They're trying to repel people from ever ordering food.
It's just
there.
A kebab joint?
Yeah.
It's good.
It's so damn good.
But like also, yeah, Istanbul and like, and just the history of, like in talking about, well, let me, I'll come back to the depression driving you, but like in talking about the new show, which seems to be, like I had a misconception. It was funny. I used to do this joke about China. Like I was, it was conceived in Vancouver. I was going through Chinatown. I was looking at Chinese markets, which I always love to do, because you don't know what's in these boxes. You're just sort of like, is that a fish? Is it a clam? Is it a bug? Is it a rock? Is that a plant? Is it a plant? And there's this moment where you realize, like, well, if you're a civilization, as long as the Chinese have been, you're gonna get around to eating everything.
Correct.
So I said, you know, and clearly the future is Chinese, because if global warming continues at its current pace, all that will be left in the ocean is prehistoric toxic algae and mutant jellyfish. And the Chinese are the only culture that really knows how to prepare that stuff properly.
That is not a joke, because it's true. Like most of Asia, like my people like eating jelly. I don't like eating jellyfish.
Yeah.
And algae is... You know, seaweed, okay. I grew up eating it. Yeah. It can be delicious.
Yeah, but that's just sort of like, you know, that's going to be an easier adjustment.
Yeah.
But it's not really happening, because they're inventing ways to make meat and stuff.
Well, we're still going to have to embrace all of these things, though. We are.
But let's go back to depression driving you. That you see, like, this is the thing that people like us get hooked to. And it's because despite our vulnerability that we have no control over, because we have, you know, mental problems, is that our ego is deeply in place.
Oh, yeah.
So you justify your behavior because it led to whatever it is you are. And if that's a good thing, it becomes hard to self-analyze.
Yeah, or I call like unfucking yourself, you know? Like
yeah, it's, exactly, yeah.
What I've realized recently, the past 2-3 years, is just because I was depressed and just because I was trying to get better and address it, I never realized how insane my fucking ego was and how narcissistic I was. Mm. Because it was like, I always felt it was just not there. Like I didn't have an ego.
Oh, like you were selfless. You were just in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, oh man, dude, come on.
Really?
Like,
so how did depression, do you think, define or make you open the first restaurant? Like, how was that the driver of your ambition?
You know, I've talked about it a lot more, and honestly, after Tony passed, I feel a lot more open to talking about this stuff, because it's never fun. Yeah, it's never fun to talk about. But like, you know, what I've realized is a lot of people need to hear stuff like this. So for me, without it seeming so dramatic, I thought I was going to end things, but before I ended things, let's try something out.
Oh, you were going to kill yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You were that depressed?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
but it wasn't going to be something that was like it was going to be look like I was in an accident riding a bike in New York City.
Oh, you had a plan.
Yeah.
That's bad when you have a plan.
Yeah. But like, I have these tendencies. I still do, you know, and you know, there's that scene in Beautiful Mind.
But they're like, I've had those tendencies too, but like mostly because my depression, like, I don't know. I through recovery and other things, I don't stay in it too long, and I don't even know if I'm you know, clinically depressed, but it's beyond self-pity, because a lot of times suicidal ideation, I used to do a joke about that too. I said, like, I think about killing myself a lot, and it's not because I want to kill myself. I just feel better knowing I can if I have to.
That's more of a true and funny.
Right? Because like there's a relief to it. If you have no real faith in place, if you're sitting there going like, oh, my life is terrible, like, I could always kill myself. Oh, okay. So I feel better. Let me go to work, right?
Right.
But you felt like you were really going to do it.
Yeah, I think it was a confluence of a lot of things. Like September 11th,
oh,
you know.
God. Yeah.
I still think people underestimate how fucking insane it was if you're in New York City.
Oh man, I was there. Yeah, the trauma of it. Like I think we're completely fucked now. The trauma of the last year and a half. I mean,
people
unresolved.
Yeah.
And we're still in it.
Yeah.
And we're not, you know, but yeah, okay.
Go ahead. I had three friends in a year pass, one of an overdose, one died in a tragic car accident, and another friend of mine, a friend of Kroll's and mine, committed suicide. So
a comedian?
No. Oh. A childhood friend.
Oh. You knew Kroll in childhood?
We had, through college, I got to know Kroll's friends growing up.
Oh.
And I was just going through my own, I felt.
This is 2011, 12?
No, 2003.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was just like in it and I couldn't get out of my own way.
Yeah.
And one way that I had alleviated depression was traveling and running away from wherever I was.
Right.
And it got to a point where I could no longer run away from my own issues and my own problems.
Right.
I was also drinking. I should have been in an AA.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah. You're
self-medicating. Incredibly addictive personality. Yeah. Right? So I just got to a place where I was like, things were not worth living. For a variety of reasons.
Yes.
And I think in some way a lot of, you know what the funny thing is? I think it's still difficult now. There's a lot of places you can get help. There's even apps and stuff.
Sure.
But back then, how the hell were you supposed to find help? I didn't grow up in a household where if I told my parents, hey, I need help, they'd be like, go to church.
Wait, were they, what kind of church?
Hardcore Christians. That's another thing.
Korean Christians.
Presbyterian. I grew up in an extremely religious household.
And I guess culturally it's not a culture, like it's same with the black community. It's just not part of the language of like, go see somebody.
No, I would get in trouble. I would have gotten in trouble if I said that. Yeah.
Go to Jesus, they said?
Yeah, or, you know, something else. I don't know. Suck it up.
So the golf thing, that was like torture.
I never liked it.
Right.
I never liked it. And
but
that
you
was
were
a lot
good
of,
at it?
You know, I think I was really good at it. I don't think I would have been good enough to make it as far as my father would have because I didn't have the mental game.
Would want you to, you mean?
Yeah. And I got recruited in high school to play a lot of golf. And
you
I traveled.
Natural talent?
I played every day.
But yeah. But still, like my brother did that with tennis too. But unless you have the natural talent, you can't go the full round.
I think I was pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been playing golf. I didn't touch a club for like 20 years.
Yeah.
It's still there a little bit.
Oh yeah. You can do it.
But this is where the dark side comes in.
Yeah.
My compulsion to be like, I'm gonna fucking do this every day. I'm gonna.
Oh, just when you picked it up lately.
Yeah, and it's not fun. I don't even enjoy playing it now. Yeah. But what I enjoy is beating myself. Right. Like. Yeah. If I can conquer myself, then that's the victory.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, maybe I'll just practice every day and join the senior tour and I'm 50. I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
That's not fun.
10 restaurants, a family, and you're making, you know, crunchy hot sauce.
Yeah. So,
you're going to make time for the...
I want to start to do things I actually enjoy.
Well, good luck with finding those.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. The golf thing messed me up big time.
It's a curse. The thing is, like, if you do something, like, even with guitar, like, I enjoy doing it, but I'm like, I'm not as good. I'm not very good at this. Like, I'm not.
I hear you say that all the time, but then I hear you play. I'm like, you're pretty good
at this. Okay, but like, I'm not fast. I know, you know, like, I'm always judging myself against, you know, everything online and every, you know, but then I'm the argument is like, but you feel, man, you can, you know, you move your feelings to it and you know, you have your own, you know, whatever.
But isn't that driving you to be better, though?
Yeah, I know, but is that what you want out
of
a hobby?
That's not fucking health.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's like, how do you find something you enjoy if you have that part of your brain that's sort of like, yeah, but there are people better than you at this.
So this is where I'm at, and it's sort of a metaphor for my life and where I want to be.
Okay.
Is like, for example, if I was playing guitar and I was competitive with myself,
yeah,
the competition is to not become competitive, to actually get to the place where I've just accepted it.
Sure.
And I can now sort of be one with it and not fight it.
Yes.
My goal is to do nothing, like to do less, to actually.
Me too. Go in the
garden.
Right?
And
yeah. Garden. Just, do you garden?
I think about it. Because when I do it, I want to do it, you know? I want to have the greenest fucking thumb anyone's ever seen.
You got a sense for it? You got a
knack? No, I don't think so, but here's the problem. I will force myself to learn how to do it. And like,
then be competing with tomatoes and cabbage.
But I'm okay because at least I'm competing against with like Mother Nature, you know? It's like random.
Right. Yeah, people seem to like it. Like I thought about putting vegetable beds out here, but then I thought like, yeah, but then I got to, I don't know. Worry about. So, all right. So the depression, though, you're saying that you opened the restaurant because it was a way of getting out of it.
and also discovering myself. You know, I talked my good friend, the artist Dave Cho. He said, you know, for you to grow, you sort of have to kill yourself.
Huh.
Right.
So, but like, so you quit the golf, and your dad was like, "What are you doing?"
Well, yeah, I was a mess. You know, I was just a hot mess.
Yeah.
I still am, but yeah. When I was a teenager, when I got to college, I felt like there was a hole in my brain that was not filled in yet.
Right. You know? So that's where all the golf went away.
Yeah. And I started just partying hard.
What did you study?
Religion.
You really need some answers, huh?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to study the philosophy. I want to know why people were religious.
Did you figure it out? I kind of know. People need to feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves so they have reason to live.
Yeah, it's faith, yeah, ultimately. Yeah, yeah. And I studied a lot of Eastern religions. I think that calmed me down a little bit.
Yeah.
But and philosophy in general was something for me to really gnaw at and to get a better understanding of thought.
Did or it like work?
It made me, I think, be a better critical thinker, but yeah. Also made me way more neurotic, too.
More darker?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know,
there is no point.
Schopenhauer's not the funnest thing to read, but if you're reading him for, like, fun, that's right. A problem.
Well, but that's the thing, when you're going into it, and I went into things like that, too, because I guess we are somewhere in that. You feel like you have something missing, so you think your natural gravitation towards anything, like, I used to do a bit about that, too. It's like, any book that I read is a self-help book. Even though they're not self-help books. Right. I'm looking for answers.
Yeah.
So when you go to Schopenhauer for answers, that's not practical philosophy. So you're just going to break your brain, and it's going to be reductive. And it's ultimately all you're going to do after that is prove to yourself that you're right and everything is shit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you come out the other side,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I spent so much time trying to unravel the myth of Sisyphus by Camus,
yeah.
Where now I'm like, I think he's wrong. Right. I don't imagine him happy going down the hill after pushing the boulder up. I think he's fucking pissed.
Sure.
You know, he's like, fuck, I got to do this fucking thing again?
Yeah, yeah, because I can't stop myself.
Yeah.
Because I'm compulsive.
But tomorrow, I think when he's pushing the boulder up, he's in the act of doing work.
Yeah.
That's his happiness.
Oh.
Because he's like, you motherfuckers can't tell me anything. You can't control me. I'm actually going to enjoy this.
Yeah.
This is not yeah. hell.
This is my
happy spot.
Yeah.
And I thought about that. I was like, you know how fucked up I have to be to think about it so much to get to that point?
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, Dave.
Yeah. Time to start cooking.
Yeah. Doing anything else.
Yeah. So what did lead to the cooking? Like, because you cooked at some pretty fancy places.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is my dad got out of the restaurant business and he worked his entire life to make sure I would never work in restaurants.
Really? What did he do?
He came to New York City in 1963
yeah.
and worked as a busboy, dishwasher several oh. years and just worked his way up until he was just a fucking hustler and wound up owning a restaurant in the Washington, D.C. area and sold that and got into the golf
business.
Oh, my
God. This is like Eddie's story.
Yeah. Very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
He got into the golf business.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a golfer.
I don't know how the hell my dad thought golf was a thing that he wanted to get into.
But what did he do in the golf business?
He sold golf clubs and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He literally was like a retailer.
Huh.
In the timing, like he chose Tyson's Corner, Virginia. When I grew up there, it was farmland.
Yeah.
I mean, people will never believe that. Like, there were like cows in my backyard.
And it's what? It's a big golf place now?
No, it's one of the biggest shopping centers and suburban sprawls anyone's ever seen.
Oh.
And there was a lot of offices, and it's now just a giant office mega complex with buildings. And the area did really well. A lot of people made a lot of money, and a lot of people played golf. So I grew up in, you know, a upper middle class upbringing from like age 13 on.
Yeah, 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 you know? Yeah. So what led to cooking?
I was terrible at everything else. I mean, there's no romantic. Yeah, there's nothing romantic. A lot of people in the 70s, 80s, and 90s got into cooking because they couldn't do anything else. So they got out of jail or,
sure.
you know, whatever. Sure. I couldn't get a job. Yeah. I had a C+ average in a religion degree.
Yeah. who's hiring?
Who's hiring, right? And I had a lot of desk jobs. I did a lot of different jobs.
Yeah.
I've done just about everything.
Yeah.
Really, so many fucking jobs. I moved from Japan I was teaching English there. I was 21, 22.
Oh, you did that? You did the teach English abroad thing?
Yeah, just to get the hell out. But I was basically in the equivalent of like Jacksonville, Florida of Japan. It was miserable. And I had to get out. It was like 1999. And anyway, I got a desk job. And I just told myself, I'm going, even if I'm good at this, I'm going to be mediocre.
Right.
This is terrible. I don't want to fucking do this.
Yeah.
So I burned all my bridges.
Yeah.
I literally told my bosses at a Christmas party how much I hated them.
Yeah.
And
all bosses everywhere.
Yeah,
fuck you all.
Fuck you all. And it was almost, I was basically inspired by Office Space, the movie. I was like, oh, fuck it. I'll just try something like this.
Yeah.
More or less, that's what I did.
And, yeah.
I was like, for me to never come back to the corporate world, I have to make it impossible for me to ever be employed here ever again. Not that I could with my grades.
What was the corporate world you were in?
I was helping companies market American depository receipts on the New York Stock Exchange.
I don't even know
what the fuck that is either, but I didn't do anything.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I spent all day trying to do nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's when I was like, I always wanted to sort of be in the culinary world. My dad really actively tried to prevent that from happening. And if my son tried to do the same thing, I would do the same thing my dad did. It's too fucking hard.
Yeah.
But I just got to a point where I don't know what the fuck I want to do.
So it's good. And also had all the good fuck you in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Everyone thought it was social suicide.
Yeah.
The advantages that I had growing up, I fucking hated high school. Like, I went to the high school that produced Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. And now I understand, of course I should have hated high school. Look at what.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Right.
But
were you treated badly?
It was not fun for me.
Yeah.
It just was hard. It was really hard for me to fit in, and I just was also a mess. I if I was someone else, I'd probably treat me poorly too, you know?
Yeah. Was your mom helpful?
No.
Mm.
I mean, she tried to love me from afar. But,
yeah. But they were together, weren't they?
Yeah, but they, you know, Korean parents, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they wound up having a solid relationship after the fact. But
yeah.
I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea. Life didn't have meaning to me. So I was like, fuck it. Let's just do what I'm not supposed to do.
And cooking.
It was either that or, like, honestly, I was like, I'll just work at a leper colony.
Yeah.
I remember thinking that to myself. I was like, fuck it.
Yeah. Why not?
Why not? Who gives a shit?
Roll the dice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you go to culinary school?
I did. I went to French Culinary Institute, and I was working at the Mercer Kitchen. I was also working at my dad's friend's golf store, New York Golf Center, on the weekends, just trying to help make ends meet.
Yeah.
Living at my sister's, just doing a lot of different things.
But right when you got to culinary school, you're like, fuck yeah.
I was so bad at it.
Oh, you were? But you were excited?
The reason why I didn't quit is I told everybody I was going to become a cook.
So
it wasn't out of overriding love of, like, I'm going to be so good at cooking.
Yeah.
I'm so good. I'm going to be awesome. It was out of the embarrassment that I can't quit.
You were terrible, huh?
Yeah, I was terrible at it. And it was also the embarrassment. I couldn't let anyone else down.
Yeah.
Including myself. So
a lot of pressure. All coming at you, all sides.
I mean, I was so bad at cooking, my first level partner decided to quit rather than continue to be my partner because she asked the instructors, if I have to continue being Dave Chang's partner, like, I'll quit. And they wouldn't change partners. She was stuck with me, so she quit.
Quit the school?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's how bad I was.
Have you been in touch with her?
So I'm a vengeful.
Yeah.
I carry a lot of chips on my shoulder. And I work so hard to prove people wrong.
Yeah.
And it's become just like a problem.
Yeah, that's
a real problem for me.
That's the ego thing too, huh?
Yeah.
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 So what's that got to do with her?
Nothing.
Oh.
I probably would have hated me too, again, I worked hard to make sure that I would be.
But you don't know who that person is?
I do know, and she's a restaurateur in New York City.
Oh, okay.
She was. And I was like, I'm gonna just smoke you. I don't know how. You're much better than me, but I'm gonna find a way.
Did you win?
Yes, I think I won.
Well, thank God. But it's a little victory.
But again, like, why? What's the purpose? You know,
because like when you're missing that piece, whether it's, you know, from, you know, bipolar or borderline or whatever, everything feels like a very personal attack, and it needs to be, the retribution needs to be satisfying. It's almost like regaining part of yourself.
I totally agree, and added on, I just, whether it was real, but I think it was real. You know, one of my college buddies said, nobody expected any of this from you, Day.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're the total surprise of anybody I've ever met.
Well, that's nice.
And it's weird. You know, it's like I'm a statistical anomaly. And yeah. I really believe that. When I tell people, oh, I shouldn't be here, they're like, no, whatever, Dave, that's self-modesty. I was like, no, I'm only here because I work my ass off. A lot of lucky breaks happen. I think about that movie Inside Llewyn Davis a lot. If I just made a right turn instead of a left turn and any number of decisions,
yeah.
I wouldn't be here.
Well, I also identify with spite being a motivator. I mean, you know, like so much of my ambition was driven by, you know, fuck that guy. Why can't I, you know what I mean? I can do that. But like, you have an empire, you know, I have a garage. But nonetheless, like what I've grown to realize, if you don't have traction and you have spite, you're not going to. You'll be pushed out.
Yeah. And I was going to be pushed out. I was a wallflower my entire life, you know?
But like, so you opened the noodle place.
Yeah.
And it's huge.
No, we were going out of business.
That was terrible.
It was, that's what I mean. It was like everything sort of happened as like a cosmic joke, right?
Yeah.
You know, nobody even cared about ramen. I mean, and again, like one reason why I wanted to do it and open up this ramen shop is I finally had an idea that I wanted it to express.
Right.
And I was like, nobody's ever given me the opportunity to actually follow through on anything.
You were a little early on the ramen thing?
Yeah, because I saw it in Japan and I grew up eating. And it's not just ramen. It was like Asian food in general.
Yeah.
And again, having been able to see the world a little bit, I was like, wait, the food in America is so stale.
Yeah.
But it's not this way everywhere else. When I was in China pre-Olympics, this is 99, I think. I had some of the best food I've ever had. It was like 25 cents a meal.
Yeah.
People forget in 2021, because food is not even a privilege, it's just a given that you should be eating well all the time.
Yeah.
Back in New York City in the late 90s,
yeah.
You couldn't eat well affordably. It yeah. didn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, other than a dirty water hot dog and stuff like that,
right.
You get a hamburger.
Right.
But there was nothing high end. Like high end was only for the high end. And if you told somebody, if the word foodie didn't even exist.
Yeah.
If you told somebody you wanted to eat well, they thought you were a snob.
Yeah.
It was an elitist thing. And right. Yes, actually it is elitist.
Yeah.
But now it's become more democratized. Uh-huh. And that was a feeling. And I loved following patterns in other, I love music. I love literature. I love ideas. And I would just see these things percolate and move. And I was like, man, nothing's ever happened here in American food. There's been no real
yeah.
change. I was like, why don't I just try to do something? Yeah. I was telling this, the only person I could tell this shit to was my shrink.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was just like solipsism.
So, and he thought like, well, this is narcissistic. This guy thinks he's yeah. going to change America.
Yeah, it's like borderline.
With noodles.
Yeah. I'm thinking the same thing. I was like, this is really problematic.
Yeah.
So
what happened? So the noodle thing didn't change the world?
No, we were going out of business. We had like 60 days left of money.
It was just mostly...
We were bad, too. Yeah. You know, no one do we want to work with.
Yeah.
I literally couldn't get anybody to work
Why?
With. Why? Because I was terrible.
You're a monster or just
no,
bad cook?
No, I was bad cook and it was yeah. terrible.
Wow. Chaos?
Yeah, we just didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I had been cooking professionally 4 years.
But this is after you work with Daniel?
Yeah. Danielle, John George, Tom Colicchio.
Colicchio's a good guy, right?
He's a good dude. And he had, again, like I was lucky to work at the opening team Kraft. I answered phones. I wanted so badly to be part of that team. I answered phones for like
But you had some sense of how a restaurant worked.
I did, but not really.
Mm.
You have no idea. You have no idea. But I worked with some of the very best cooks.
Yeah.
And all of those figures were like big brothers to me. And my friend Akhtar Nawab said, like, I knew you were going to be maybe something when Marco Canora was like, hey, bring me some gremolata, Dave. And I was like, make me like a quarter gremolata. And I was like, yeah, chef. And I come back sheepishly 5 minutes later, chef, I don't know what gremolata is. But like, just that, like, I'm going to do it approach.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was it. And honestly, I look back on it, it was totally insane what happened. That beginning year.
Yeah.
And honestly, we only became successful when we started to throw the rule book out and we started to do
with
everything.
With the new restaurant? Or with
no,
the
original restaurant, we started to be the most obnoxious pricks anybody's ever seen.
Yeah.
We'd kick people out. We'd play, you know, Wu-Tang, Enter 36 Chambers, Metallica, whatever.
Yeah.
We were playing obnoxious music we were finally, we freed ourselves from the shackle of what a restaurant or noodle bar should be. We just started to fuck around.
Yeah.
Because I literally viewed us as a terminal cancer patient.
Yeah.
And at that point, because I've had a lot of cancer in my family, it's like you start to do whatever the fuck. Who cares?
Yeah.
You start living.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with us, in both as a restaurant and for myself.
Yeah.
Like, I started to become someone else, and it started to work, and it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was the craziest time. So
it caught on.
It worked. Yeah. I still don't know how the hell it worked, and it was right place, right time, and I don't think it was because of me or anyone else. It could have been easily somebody else.
And then you just started opening restaurants.
Because we had to take, I wanted to take care of everybody. The reason we opened a second restaurant is we needed to get more money to pay for healthcare for
everybody. What was the second restaurant?
Sambar, which we almost went out of business again.
Yeah.
Because I decided to do Asian burritos.
Yeah. But it caught on?
No, it was a total failure. It was a total fucking dud. I mean, it was all this hype.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, just open another bigger noodle bar, because the first one was tiny, 600 square feet, the size of this garage.
Yeah.
And I took this thing out of receivership, got a giant loan, $1 million loan. I would have lost everything. My dad put his golf store for collateral.
So eventually your dad was on board.
Yeah. That was when he knew I was on board when I moved next door to the first restaurant in this cockroach infested little apartment. And he was like, you're crazy.
Yeah, but you mean it.
You mean it now. You know, this isn't a hobby. You're fucking nuts. My son is nuts.
Yeah.
And that restaurant was so... I think, honestly, ahead of its time, unfortunately, but we were going out of business. Our accountant said, like, you have 3 weeks left of money. And if that happened, everything defaulted.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck. Like, I literally thought to myself, maybe I have to sell drugs. I can sell marijuana or something.
Yeah.
Like, these are the crazy things you start thinking about when you have to make things work.
Yeah.
Well, before I do something stupid like that, why don't I just open up 24/7?
Right. Yeah.
Because what else can I do?
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to give up on these burritos, so I'll be open from 12 to 4 in the morning. I just won't sleep. I won't sleep.
But people just didn't want the burritos.
Yeah, no. And I was like, I'll just fucking work. I worked my ass off. Everybody did. We had the sickest team. God bless them. And
did
we
you use
worked
regular
from 12 to 4.
Tortillas?
Yeah. Mm. A flour. It was like mushu pork.
No, I get it. Yeah. I get it. But like, because it seems like you've evolved the bread concept. Like, it still seems that there's some element of the Asian burrito that you hang on to.
Oh, 100%. I'm not, it is like my Ishtar.
Yeah.
You know, I can't, and I still believe it works, but from 12 to 4 in the morning, we decided, well, who gives a fuck? We're just going to start cooking whatever the fuck we want to cook.
Yeah.
We had Tin Ho, we had Kino Baca, Peter Serpico, we had all of these great, great chefs and cooks, Corey Lane, a great team, and next thing you know, people are coming in from, were jam-packed from 12 to 4 in the morning, every night of the week.
Huh.
And it took me 6 more months to give up my ego-driven idea of a burrito, be like, maybe we should just do this all day.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And that's how we survived.
And then what was the first restaurant that you were like, this really, you know, worked? Was it after that, after the Asian burrito place?
We did Co, 12-seat restaurant. I never wanted to do fine dining. The only reason, long story, we got into fine dining is we were doing so much business at a one restaurant that we got shut down by the health department because we didn't have enough hot water.
And this is all pre-truck.
Yeah.
Because food trucks are a different thing.
Roy Choi started to get huge right around this time, 2009, 2010. And so... we needed to make ends meet because we had a loan out for that first restaurant that supported Sambar. So by the time Sambar started to make money and pay the loans back, I still would have lost everything because I needed Noodle Bar to still make money.
But that wasn't.
Well, we were going to get we got shut down by the health department.
Right, because of the
water. So oh, fuck, what are we going to do? So we just reverse engineered. Like, how much money do we need to make and how many people can we cook for per day and have enough hot water for those people? So that was 24 people.
Yeah.
So we opened a restaurant for 24 fucking people.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do fine dining.
Which restaurant was that?
It was Co.
And that worked out good?
That worked. It was crazy because we were the first restaurant that did a reservation system that was totally democratic. There was no way I could rig it for my friends. It was 12 seats. I don't need a reservationist. And I didn't want to bother the team with answering the phone. Yeah. It was like, let's just build a system where people can go online. This is the first of its kind, sort of. and just do it from themselves. It's totally transparent. You see every day, 7 days out, if you got the reservation or you didn't.
Yeah.
And it was like fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And that's when things got super insane in my life and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the profile of that restaurant.
Yeah.
And then your whole life.
And in living in New York City, it just became like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was totally fucking nuts.
And you liked it?
I was so caught up in it. Yeah. And I felt, now in retrospect, I can see that I let my ego get in the way. And I wanted a lot of things to happen to survive. But part of it was survival.
Yeah.
I think that clearly I mistreated a lot of people with my temper.
Now are you a guy that apologizes?
I want to just make things right with everybody I possibly can, you know. So I haven't apologized to everybody, and I'm still working through a lot of things.
Have there been some that are just like, no, fuck you?
There are some people that hate my guts. You know, and the way I can reconcile that is by passing on my father. Is like, I was so angry at him for so long. And that's the fucking crazy thing. I was wound up being the father figure, same father figure to my own employees in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that messed me up.
Like your dad. You acted like him.
100%.
Mm. But it seems like you have people that have been with you for years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also, like, obviously early on, you cared about healthcare and you took care of your people. But you were just one of those difficult people.
I was a total fucking prick.
Let's try to be diplomatic.
You know, and you know, I've done a lot of therapy as to why. Like, one of the reasons I spent so much time besides depression was understanding, like, why do I get angry? This didn't exist in me. This, and I learned it was effective. It's called effective dysregulation of my emotions.
Huh? What is that? Maybe I have it. I've shut down though lately.
Yeah.
Yeah. My rage is gone. In terms of dumping it on people. I know enough about how bad that is.
I think with a lot of behavioral therapy for me, I mean, this is years of me doing this. Medicine, I'm like, it's harder for that to come out like the Hulk, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
But for me, if I see something happen, like if somebody does something ridiculously stupid and not stupid, but stupid in the sense that it's not important. It's they don't condense something properly into another container.
Right, right.
I might freak the fuck out.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand it. And one of which is like, I've learned that doing that right gave me meaning, saved my life.
Right.
And in a world where everything had let me down in my life.
Yeah.
With exception of like books.
Yeah.
And ideas.
Yeah.
And cooking saved my life.
Yeah.
It taught me order.
Yeah.
That if you didn't care about it as much as I did, you were attacking me.
Right. Right. Yeah. See, that's that thing where it's personal.
It's personal.
Yeah.
And it's taken me a long time. I'm still working at it to know that it's not personal.
Yeah.
Why should anybody else care about it as much as I do?
Right.
And
they got their own problems.
Yeah. And
right.
I was just like, you talk about this a lot in your pod, like, I'm so embarrassed.
Yeah.
By my inability to have been better in the past.
Yeah.
And I'm trying my best to be better moving forward. But that's all I can do.
It is. So the evolution of restaurants, though, you've got how many open still?
10 plus.
Okay.
Again, I say that because there's multiples of certain things.
Yeah. And are you active in engaged?
Nope. No. We have a CEO. We have a culinary team. I'm there as support and to answer things, but the day-to-day operations, I've been out of for a few, like 3-4 years.
You don't make menus?
No.
Mm.
No.
See, and that doesn't bother your control issues?
It's a lot of therapy, Mark.
Yeah.
To get to that point.
Because I would think that would be crazy. You open multiple restaurants and you delegate.
Yeah.
It seems to me horrifying.
Delegating is extremely difficult to do because a lot of people do it, but being good at it is another thing, right?
And
I learned that you can get people to do a lot of different things. You can yell at them, you can scare them, you can basically force people to do what you want them to do. But when your back is turned, will they do it willingly on their own volition?
Or will they spite you?
Yeah, and I think the only way to do that is through being kind, being communicative, being open, being transparent, being vulnerable, being all these things that I think are extremely hard for anybody to do. And it's ultimately, I think, being a good parent.
Yeah.
And teaching them the ways and encouraging them to make mistakes and have ownership in it and to make decisions under duress as best they can. And they're not robots.
Mm.
So it's hard.
Yeah.
But it's still a work in progress. And there was a long time where I'd see something not right and I'd be like, you know. And I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
right.
Fuck. But how would I have known better?
I know, but sometimes embarrassment, like the shame element of what we're talking about here can only, sometimes if you're not careful with that, you're just going to use it as a bat to beat yourself up with, right?
So, well, and I beat myself up. I'm so sorry to so many people that I've fucking pissed off and I hurt. And, you know, when I hear you talk about it, it moves me when I'm in my car driving. I'm like, fuck, man. Like, I know that feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't want to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
That's really just who I am. But fuck.
Yeah.
It's the worst feeling.
I know. Yeah. And it's because of this emotional liability and mental thing. But you seem vigilant, and that's all you can do is, you know, think for, you know, take a breath. Like, I've been a little bad lately with the, like, in the quick emails, like, oh, fuck you, dude.
Are you doing better, though, you think?
In general?
Yeah.
In life?
I mean, you've had a hard year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think the grief thing is what it is, and you know, that's moving along, but sort of like, you know, I'm not sure that some of the anger that's coming is not relative to that, like, you know, that you have to, there's a certain amount of acceptance around tragedy that has to happen because it is what it is, and it happens to people. But like, I don't really know why, outside of the world ending, you know, which I can displace it onto that, but like, I am feeling a little more angry than usual, and I don't, and the solutions that usually kind of work for me are not quite working. I'm a little detached. How about you?
I feel guilty because I think I put my head in the sand for a good few months.
You did?
Yeah. Just I think part of it was just nesting, getting ready for a new child.
Right, yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
But I've been also asking myself, these fucking questions, like, what am I doing?
Right.
You know, like, one reason why I was so hesitant to have children is just because my own fucking genetic makeup.
Yeah, you want to spare them.
Yeah.
Right, but your wife's sort of like, ah.
Yeah, And I think being a father has been, I never thought I could love something other than myself as much as I do now. And I think it's been everything
I
needed.
And you barely love yourself.
Yeah. Right?
So you mean you never thought you could love something, period.
Yeah. Really, right. Truly. Yeah.
Selflessly.
And I think
selflessly.
Love is something I've never really experienced up until, like, you know, my wife. And now I just feel like I'm in a different phase of my life, and I'm trying my best to surrender to the need for control.
Yeah.
And I think that is why I'm not so angry at the absurdity that you read about every day.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think children do that. And it seems to me that, like, whether it's food or whether it's, you know, depression, that, you know, acting as if or you know, being vigilant around behavior for yourself, like, you can change the way you are if through repetition. And you've said it a million times, it's like golf, it's like anything else. And you have the capacity to do that. Now you just have to apply it to, you know, behavior, right?
But this is another thing I've been working on a lot.
Yeah.
Just because you know it and you think it all the time doesn't mean you fucking do it.
Right. No, I get that. But it's sort of like, I haven't drank or do drugs over 20 years. How'd that happen? I don't know. But now I don't even think about it. You know, like, also with anger. Like, you know, I don't have anyone around that I'm going to unload on. But, like, you know, I've been a rageful asshole. And like, I don't really feel the need to do it because I feel it coming. Right? So you make choices to do things differently. I mean, intellectually, yeah. Intellectually knowing something. Like, I know what's wrong with me. I know this. But, you know, you're in an active environment with a family. So, like, I imagine whatever shortcomings you have, there's plenty of days where you choose the right thing.
And I still beat myself up when I get angry or I do something. I hold myself to a standard that is just not achievable.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, you just, you know, you just got to tighten up, It's like I used to do a joke about that too, where it's sort of like you got to get the distance in between fuck you and I'm sorry. You got to keep tightening that up to where the fuck you doesn't happen.
Right. Very true.
Right? So your relationship with Tony, now, like, what did you guys both were depressives? Did you know it each other in each other or?
I think those that know Tony, and Tony had a lot of like siloed off relationships with a lot of people. I think initially Tony sort of knew that I was going to be highly combustible.
Yeah.
I think that was intriguing for him. And if you spend enough time with Tony, if you watch even his shows, he talks about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's just there.
Right.
So he just white knuckled heroin.
Yeah.
And I think for him, he thought he could white knuckle anything. Because if you can do that to heroin, you can do that to anything.
Right.
And he just he couldn't.
Yeah.
You can't run away from your addiction.
Yeah.
So, this is just a lot. There's so much to fucking this Tony story. I think ultimately.
Were you guys really close?
He was like a bigger brother to me.
Yeah. But in touch and actively.
Yeah, a little bit less so the last 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to bother him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he was always there. And whenever I needed anything, he was there. And I just didn't want to bother him because everybody wanted something from him.
Mm.
And I didn't want to be that person.
Yeah.
But so.
When it happened, were you surprised? I mean, obviously it's surprising because it's tragic.
Yeah,
but were you like, well, I could.
I think for a lot of people, everyone thought it might have been like, part of me was hoping it would just be old age, right?
Yeah.
Part of me thought, if anything, it might be heroin again. You know?
Right.
I didn't see it coming this way.
Yeah.
And it was a total surprise to me.
Yeah. And you found out pretty quickly when it happened, right?
Yeah. It was, it totally was a fucking, and I still. It's hard to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that isolated. But it was right around when you were finding out you're going to have a baby.
Well, that was hard.
Yeah.
One of my last real meaningful conversations I had with him, we had dinner, and we talked about Lori Woolover, his assistant, has a book out about Tony. It's like a compilation of a bunch of stories. The doc was out and in it, and I don't even know why the fuck I said it to begin with, because I was still angry at him. He was just like, he was projecting. He was like, you're going to be a fucking terrible father, Dave.
Yeah.
You know, before I even had a kid, you know, because he felt, because I am.
Yeah.
And you are as well.
Right.
And that fucked me up.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not a believer in fate or shit like that at all, but I think about it a lot.
Yeah.
And I think about Tony every day when I see my son, because we had been trying to get, my wife had been trying to get pregnant for a couple years, and there was a lot of obstacles in the way. And it got to the point where it's like, oh, probably will never happen.
Yeah.
And that day was scheduled to go to the fertility clinic.
Yeah.
So you're just like, yeah.
Killed himself. Yeah.
So you're like, there's this window to, you know, I was just not in a fucking place. You know, it's like the last fucking thing I wanted to do.
Was that.
Oh my God.
Donate some sperm.
Oh my God.
But you did it.
And
And that was the one?
That was the one.
Well, you'll think about him every day then.
Fuck. I mean, I really do. It's such a fucking mind fuck.
But it's positive in a way.
Here's the craziest thing.
Yeah.
For number two.
The new kid.
I got a call from his agent, Kim, who wanted to talk about Tony.
Yeah.
The fucking moment I'm going to the elevator to the fertility clinic.
Oh, get out of here.
And I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Did you name him Tony?
No. I've never told really anybody that.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I mean, it's an active presence, but I don't know that it's negative. Do you? Seems positive to me.
I think part of me is it's just randomness.
Sure. And you're attaching meaning to it.
And I'm trying to tell myself, don't do that.
Okay. But I mean, the meaning's not terrible.
No, it's not. I think it's a positive. And I want people to think about Tony in a positive way.
He
impacted so many people in positive ways. And I wouldn't have a career that I have right now without Tony. And
as a role model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was the fucking best.
Yeah.
He was the fucking best, yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, when I first talked to him, it was great. The second time, he was mad at me. And, you know, that was the last time I saw
him. Well, Tony got mad at a lot of people at the end, you know?
Yeah, it was about that stuff, too. You know, he came on the show again to promote something, but he had a beef, you know, and I got it. But, you know, that, and we weren't friends, but that was the last encounter I had with him.
Right.
He was mad.
I think that was one reason why, and if anybody's listening, like, if I have a conversation with a friend or somebody that you know that might could be the last conversation you have with them, that's what I regret about a lot. Is like, I think there were a lot of moments where I should have had that fucking conversation.
Yeah.
But I was afraid of being cut out of his life.
Right.
And it's a hard thing for people to
Which
have.
Conversation? Oh, the one where you're just worried?
You're worried or anything. You know, it's like,
yeah. What are you doing, buddy?
What are you doing?
Yeah. And then the risk is, fuck you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but congratulations on the new kid, and you seem to be doing well. But let's the new show seems like a kind of like a reaction, sort of like, how can I help?
Yeah, well, you know, it started out with the beginning of the pandemic, and you talked about people trying to process what the fuck happened the past 18 months, and I think it's going to take a generation to understand.
Sure. If we last that long,
is under, you know, what really felt like the end of the world, March 2020.
Yeah.
And we were just talking to people in my industry, and next thing you know, it was like, how do we do this? And we have this thing with deal with Hulu, and I was apprehensive because I didn't want it to be a depressing show.
What's it called again?
Next Thing You Eat.
Okay.
And part of it was looking at the entrepreneurs, the technology, the people that are going to give us hope. Potentially.
Yeah.
And
in the food world.
In the food world, in the restaurants and how we consume things. It's not a prescriptive show. It's not, this is what's going to happen. I think what I wanted with Morgan and the team was, how do we start having conversations, right? About the meaning of something.
Yeah.
For example, if we do have cultivated meats, which I think we 100% will, whether you like it or not, we're going to fucking have it.
Like man-made meat.
Man-made meat.
Yeah.
I bet my fucking life on it.
Yeah.
Because by 2050, we're not going to have enough protein to feed the people on this planet.
Yeah.
So protein units is what people in the industry call it. You're going to need to find ways.
Like
2050.
Okay.
Which is not that far away.
Right.
People are not going to stop eating meat or the desire to eat meat. That's just genetically coded in our DNA.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people that are pumping ungodly amount of money to recreate meat from cells.
Yeah.
And I tasted it and it's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit.
Really?
And that's when I was like, to me, the equivalent was for food.
Yeah.
It was like the equivalent of teleportation.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like, my God.
We can do this.
We could what?
So you just got to shift our perception to accept it.
But then like you should the conversation, like, what does this mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you're a practicing Muslim or kosher.
Yeah. Is it pork?
Yeah. Can you eat pork now?
Well, those are fun questions. But
yeah.
The bigger question is, will it work to provide a reasonable protein source for people who need it when it's diminishing?
Yeah. And it will be cheap. And people think, only rich people eat that. No, actually, I think only poor to lower income people will eat it. And rich people will eat the real shit.
Mm. And you deal with technology's effect on the food business, that's obviously technology, but it looks like in the production and
the robotics growing. That to me is what we got to figure out. And you know, I grew up thinking that you're going to have the Jetsons or something you see on Star Trek, but the future's going to look a lot like what we are eating right now.
Yeah, and but does it mean that those amazing markets in Turkey go away?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, COVID, again, accelerated everything in life. But I think the change moving from here on out with food is going to happen more gradually, where you're not going to know. We're the frog in the in the hot bath, and we're not knowing that the temperature is being increased ever so slightly.
Yeah, but that's not the outcome we want, is it?
No, but the outcome, I believe, is positive because it's going to shift because the people that work in this business are too gritty And I think it's going to shift. I think we're going to be eating, clearly we're eating a lot more at home. But I feel very confident that what is consumed at home is going to be a growing business and people are going to be express themselves. Maybe they won't open a restaurant right off the bat. Maybe they'll open a restaurant in their home first, see if it works, and then open a restaurant.
But, interesting.
I am actually hopeful and I have optimism that it's not going to be just like, again, like Demolition Man and Taco Bell in the future.
Oh, good. Well, that's exciting. And you got a new cookbook?
Yep.
And that's
coming out October 21st.
What's that called?
Cooking at Home.
All right. So it's sort of similar themed.
Yeah. It's basically don't use recipes. I mean, there's recipes, but it's trying to teach you intuition.
Do you like that cookbook, The Fire of Salt?
Oh, Samin, she's fucking, you know.
Yeah.
She's next level. That book is stupid good.
You love it.
Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. And that TV show she has on Netflix is fantastic.
I haven't watched it. It's good.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
All right, man. Well, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
And thanks for the Grateful Dead record and the chili stuff. And you guys are going to send me more food stuff?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
At least we could do, man.
Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
That's it. That was good. That was deep. We got some work done. The Next Thing You Eat is now streaming on Hulu. The cookbook, Cooking at Home, comes out next Tuesday. Did I mention I want one? October 26th. I'd like to get one in the mail. Thank you. Thank you. Should I do this on the phone? Should I do it through a DM? Should I text? I'd like a book. Can I? Wait to hear the crunch on this little Fender Champ. Austin Hooks hot rodded it out in Texas, sent it back to me. Now I'm going to crunch it. Monkey and La Fonda and Cat Angels Everywhere. I don't even know if I like that one.